I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. On land, in the sea, and through the air, animals of all kinds create swarms. Whether to confuse a predator or to increase their chances of finding food, the hive mind is very useful. Today, a different kind of conversation about the birds and the bees. This one's about how researchers study flocking animals to create better, safer artificial intelligence for humans. Then, if you didn't already know about Monday's total solar eclipse, you might be living under a rock. We'll meet the University of Missouri astronomer who wants to get as many people as possible into the path of totality. Later, Brian McTavish presents the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There is safety in numbers. Just look at a swarm of bees, a colony of ants, a flock of birds, or a school of fish. Their numbers confuse predators and provide protection. What also occurs in these gatherings is a group intelligence, a combination of individual intellects that allow a swarm to act as one to overcome challenges and threats. Humans don't naturally share a swarm intelligence, but what would it be like if we did? Louis Rosenberg is exploring that very idea with more than 350 patents awarded for his work in virtual reality, augmented reality, and human-computer interaction. Rosenberg has turned his attention to artificial intelligence. He's the CEO of Unanimous AI, which focuses on applying swarm intelligence in nature to human decision-making. Louis Rosenberg is in town for tomorrow's TEDx KC conference, but this morning he joins me here in the studio, and welcome to Kansas City. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I was going to ask, what is artificial intelligence? And then I thought it might be better to ask what AI is not. But you say, Louis, there's a more basic question out there that we should be asking, and that is what?
So the first question is, what is intelligence?
What is intelligence?
And the way I look at intelligence is to say, intelligence is a system that can take in noisy information about the world and give out as output predictions, decisions, opinions, basically useful information. And so intelligence is ultimately a system that allows us to make sense of the world. And so when we talk about artificial intelligence,
I was going to say,
the question is, well, how do we create that? How do we create that artificially? And so, when researchers started looking at building artificial intelligence, they've generally looked to nature for inspiration.
Help me with that, because is that where swarms come in?
It does. Although, in the world of artificial intelligence, which really started in the 1950s, when researchers started looking to say, well, how does nature build an intelligence? The first place that researchers looked was the most familiar kind of intelligence that we know, our own brains. And so starting in the 1950s, the very first types of artificial intelligence were modeled after human brains, which at that point, in the 50s, we just started to understand that a human brain was a collection of neurons. And by connecting neurons together in systems, intelligence emerged. And so researchers started building artificial neurons and creating artificial neural networks. And so the vast majority of AI research really looks at that approach. What has interested me, and what really has been the inspiration for the company that we started, Unanimous AI,
right,
is that nature actually has another way it builds intelligence. Yes, there's neurological intelligence, which are systems of neurons, but nature also has swarm intelligence, which is systems of organisms. And when we talk about swarm intelligence, we really mean a wide variety of natural systems, like flocks of birds, schools of fish, swarms of bees. Biologists refer to all these things as swarms, and a swarm intelligence is this idea that these systems behave as a superorganism. They behave as a single entity that can think together, and they are significantly smarter together as a system than they are as individuals.
The idea that three or four people are smarter together than one person by him or herself.
Right. So there's the old saying, you know, two heads are better than one. And you could then imagine, well, 10 heads are better than one. And when you get to, you know, schools of fish and swarms of bees, nature shows us that hundreds and hundreds of heads thinking together as a system can be much, much smarter than any one of those individuals.
Let's extrapolate that out just for a moment, Lewis, because your organization, Unanimous AI, was challenged to predict the 2016 Oscars. You did, and correctly predicted 76% of the awards. How did swarms of bees get you there?
Right. So there's lots of different types of systems in nature that form swarm intelligence. Honeybees happen to be the organism that's the best understood. People have been studying how honeybees make decisions as swarms really since the 1950s. And it's remarkable. And so it's worth giving a little credit to the bees in terms of how much smarter they are as a system. And so honeybees, they have lots of very difficult problems to solve. One of the most important problems they have to solve is finding a new home. And so what they do is every year a colony will send out hundreds of scout bees, and they'll search a 30-square-mile area to find potential home sites that they can move into. And these home sites are, you know, a hollow log or the hole in the side of a building or the hole in your roof. And it's, you know, going out and finding the sites is the easy part. And they find dozens of potential sites. The hard part is that they then need to pick the best possible site. And remarkably, they do it. Biologists have shown that honeybees will pick the best possible solution across all of these different sites over 80% of the time.
That's interesting.
And it's amazing to understand how complicated the problem is, because when they need to pick a home, they have a whole bunch of different constraints. They need to pick a home that's large enough to store the honey that they need for the winter, that's ventilated well enough so it stays cool in the summer, that's insulated well enough so it can stay warm on cold nights. It has to be near a good source of water, but also has to be protected from the rain. And of course, it needs to be near lots of good sources of pollen. So it's, you know, location is everything. And so it's this very complex problem. And so if you were a person looking at all the potential sites and looking at all these different constraints, it would be very, very difficult to pick the perfect solution. And if you were a human, you might face a similar problem. Like if you were trying to find the perfect location to put a new restaurant or a new store, you'd have a similar problem. Very hard to pick the perfect solution. A honeybee has a tiny, tiny brain. Mm-hmm. It couldn't possibly comprehend that problem. And yet when they think together as a system, as a swarm, they can solve it so accurately that a person would struggle to do it. And people often wonder, well, how can honeybees think together as a system? How do they combine
right.
their knowledge and their wisdom into a single system that can have an output? And the way bees do it is also remarkable. They do it by vibrating their bodies. And so biologists call it a waggle dance, because to people, it literally looks like the bees are all dancing. And back in the 1950s, scientists figured out what that dance means. And literally, when the bees are vibrating their bodies, they're generating signals that represent their support for the different home sites that they've discovered.
You're just killing me here.
And the signals are so accurate. It's actually crazy that one bee can see the vibration of another bee. And that signal will tell them exactly where that site is. It could be 3 miles away in a log, and that bee can go find that other site 3 miles away based on the information in that signal. And so by combining these signals, hundreds and hundreds of bees will all be vibrating their bodies, and they will they'll basically engage in this multi-directional tug of war, kind of pushing and pulling, you know, factions forming in support of different options until they converge on the one home site that they can best agree is the best one. And when they converge on that solution, it's almost always the optimal solution. They basically are solving a complex multivariable problem by thinking together, and which was really the inspiration for myself and for our company to say, well, if bees can do it, and if birds can do it, and if fish can amplify their intelligence by thinking together in systems, you know, why can't people do it?
That's so interesting. So what does that have to do with predicting the 2016 Oscars or the Kentucky Derby? You picked the top four finishers. Yeah.
Right. So what we've been working on for the last 4 years is this question of, well, can people form a swarm intelligence? Now, we didn't evolve the ability to do it. People don't know how to waggle dance.
Right.
And so what we've done is we've studied how natural swarms amplify the intelligence of groups, and we've modeled those systems, and we've created the algorithms and interfaces that allow groups of people to connect online and answer questions together and amplify their intelligence. And one of the ways we like to test the power of human swarms is by having journalists give us challenges. And so you mentioned the Kentucky Derby. And so CBS Interactive challenged us to predict the Kentucky Derby last year. And the thing to know is we don't know anything about horse racing. We had never done anything like that before. But we said, okay, let's see if we can form an online swarm intelligence. And so we found 20 horse racing enthusiasts who logged into our system and formed a swarm. And we had them think together as a swarm to predict not just the winner of the race, but the first four horses in order. And so in horse racing, that's called the superfecta. Mm-hmm. And last year it went off at 540-1 odds. And so we had this swarm make their predictions for first place, second place, third place, fourth place. And then the reporter published the story. In fact, the reporter went to the Kentucky Derby and actually placed a bet on the superfecta and tweeted out her ticket. So we had a lot of pressure on us. And remarkably, the swarm was perfect. They wow. correctly predicted wow. The superfecta. So anyone who had placed a $20 bet would have won $11,000. And thankfully, I placed a $20 bet, so I won $11,000.
Wow.
The
wow.
reporter placed a bet. A bunch of her readers placed bets. In fact, one of her readers reported winning $50,000. And so it's amazing that the swarm was so accurate. But the more amazing thing is that if we look at those 20 individuals who participated, we also asked them just to predict on their own, and not a single one of them on their own got all four horses correct. Huh. And in fact, we also asked them to take a vote. Taking a vote, they only got one horse right out of the four. But when they formed a system, when they could think together as a system, connected by AI algorithms, they were perfect. And and that's really the power of swarm intelligence. It allows us to be smarter together than the individuals can be on their own.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about swarm intelligence and how it might work and what it might mean for us going down the road. We're visiting with Louis Rosenberg, who is CEO of Unanimous AI. He's in town for tomorrow's TEDxKC conference. If you have a question for Louis, we have him for just a few more minutes. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So what's the potential for this going forward? Where can you see it being applied in practical ways that might help all of us, Louis?
Yeah, so the way we look at it, we're really at the very beginning of the potential of swarm intelligence, and our expectation is that the technology and the algorithms and the systems will get better and better, and swarms of people will be able to connect online and have deeper insights about everything, from political questions to medical questions to solving business questions. We currently do projects across a wide range of applications. We do projects for large companies where they want to tap the intelligence of their business team, mm-hmm. And so you could imagine that you could take 20 salespeople, and together they can make a more accurate sales forecast. Or you could take 20 people who are engineers, and together they can come up with better product features. Or you could imagine that you could take a group of medical professionals who are maybe assessing a difficult medical case, and maybe they have all different perspectives, because a medical team generally has an oncologist, a radiologist, an internist. You have lots of different perspectives, and they might all have different views on how to best treat a patient. But if they could think together as a swarm intelligence, they could converge on the best combination of their knowledge and their wisdom and their insights. And so long-term, we really see the ability to allow people to form systems that are smarter together than the individuals on their own.
Well, what about something like the election last November, where you had lots of different pollsters conducting polls? All those polls were pulled together, and still the combined result suggested that Hillary Clinton was going to beat Donald Trump.
Yeah, no, we compare against polls all the time because people have this idea that polling is the best way to understand a population. The thing is, if you look at the millions of years of evolution of birds and bees and fish, you know, they don't use polls. Mm-hmm. They use systems. And the reason for that is that polls are polarizing. What a poll does is it tells us the differences in a population, but it doesn't tell us what the population can agree upon, whereas a swarm is the opposite. A swarm isn't telling us how people disagree. A swarm will find those things that allow a population to agree. And there's a reason for that. If honeybees were trying to find the best location for a new home, and they entrenched the way people do into different factions, and they just couldn't agree, they would die out. Instead,
which is the genius of honeybees,
right? Which is the reason they're still around after 30 million years is that when they form a swarm, they actually find the solution that's best for the group as a whole, as opposed to splitting into factions. And so, polling is a human invention that actually forces us to break into subgroups, whereas swarming is really nature's way of tapping the diverse ideas of a population and finding the
solutions. Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date.
Good. I want to ask your guest. I've had an idea for several years of having a group intelligence, maybe a swarm, to concentrate on moving a ball from point A to point B. Do your swarms ever, can you think of anything you could do that would involve physical changes, moving things or changing things? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Frank.
Sure. That's a great question. And the systems that we create are actually very visual, meaning when we have swarms come into our platform, the groups of people can actually move objects across the screen together. We've even had swarms of people solve mazes, graphical mazes, where they will move a pointer through a maze together. And what's really interesting when we did that is that the group is able to solve the maze faster together than individuals can solve them on their own. And so
that's interesting.
It is really interesting when we start looking at physical things that a swarm can do, as opposed to just a decision.
How does a swarm account for ego and as you mentioned earlier, people being stuck in their views and insisting that their way is the right way? Are they simply overwhelmed by numbers in a sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something we look at a lot, which is the makeup of the population makes a difference, and the personalities of the population makes a difference. And one of the things that we look at is what types of people are the best performers in a swarm. And the people that are the best performers are the ones who know what they know and also know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the worst performers are ones who think they know everything and they don't. And
I get it.
When we predicted the Oscars last year for Newsweek, we had a swarm of people who were really, really accurate. They were 76% accurate when predicting the Oscars, which was better than the New York Times, the LA Times, Variety magazine. And these were just regular movie fans. And the thing is, we asked those people, how many of you have actually seen all the movies? None of them had seen all the movies. But that's that magic of a swarm, is that they're combining not just their knowledge, but their confidence. And so people who might have seen certain films will know that they might have strong opinions, where people who didn't see those films maybe have weaker opinions. And so you're combining not just their view, but you're allowing them to express how confident they are in their view. And if they're well calibrated, if they know what they know and know what they don't know, then they can be very, very effective.
Louis Rosenberg again is CEO of Unanimous AI. He's in town for tomorrow's TEDxKC conference. You can go to TEDxKC's website to get information on how to watch the proceedings tomorrow evening. Such interesting stuff. Thanks for coming in. Sure,
yeah,
appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with another expert from TEDxKC about next Monday's solar eclipse. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We'll be right back. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we learned about the role prosecutors can play in changing the criminal justice system. Also, we checked in on the state of organized labor in Missouri. Find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's show, we meet the man who's reviving Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign, and we'll discuss the effect President Trump is having on race relations. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. If you've tried emailing Angela Speck in the last couple of months, you probably received this auto reply. Hello, although I'm probably not actually out of the country or even out of the state, I could be just about anywhere on the path of totality, attempting to prepare the nation for the impending zombie apocalypse that will be the first total solar eclipse on the continental U.S. in nearly four decades. Consequently, I may or may not read your messages in a timely manner. Feel free to send me reminders with whatever cadence makes you most comfortable. Normality may or may not be restored on or around August 29th. The reply is not all that strange if you know that Dr. Beck is not just a professor of astrophysics and director of astronomy at the University of Missouri-Columbia. She's also co-chair of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force. That means she's been pretty busy. Dr. Beck actually found some time to get to the studios of KBIA at Mizzou today, and she joins us now. Dr. Beck, so nice to have you. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
How busy is a member of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force these days?
Honestly, I'm going to sleep a lot when this is all over. There is no time in my schedule at all.
What's the purpose of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force?
So our goal has been to try and prepare the entire nation for this event. We actually were formed about 3 years ago by the American Astronomical Society, which is the big professional body for astronomers in the U.S. And the whole point was that when an eclipse happens, it happens about once a year somewhere on the planet, and it can be chaotic. And we wanted to make sure that the country was ready for it, but also that everybody got to make the most of it. I want everybody looking at the sky on Monday.
Because
there will be a total solar eclipse, and it will be the first chance for many people in this country to see one, and it may be their only chance.
How cool is this thing going to be?
So, you see a picture of the Grand Canyon, and you think, oh, that's cool, I'd like to see that. And then you see it in the flash, and you go, ah! Well, now I want you to imagine the Grand Canyon, but there's a volcano in the middle that's erupting, but it's in the sky. That's how cool this is going to be.
You call this thing the zombie apocalypse eclipse. Why?
Well, so, we haven't had an eclipse like this in the modern era. The last time there was an eclipse on the mainland U.S. was 1979, and that was only up in the Northwest. The last time we had one that crossed from coast to coast was 1918. And now we have social media. We have all of these opportunities for people to learn about this and know it's coming. And it is going to be like, chaos across the world, well, across the country, across all of the roads. Places are going to run out of food. There's not going to be enough hotels. So it's kind of like a zombie apocalypse, except that zombies don't need to eat or sleep or poop.
You have this all figured out, don't you?
Yeah.
Are you surprised at all, Dr. Beck, in terms of how big a deal this eclipse has become?
Can I just start? My name is Speck, not Beck.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Ask the question again for me.
Yeah. Are you surprised at all about how big a deal this eclipse has become?
No. This is something that if you look at what happens in other countries when there are eclipses, it's always a big deal. If we look at what happened in 79 in the Portland area, if we look at what or the Tacoma area, if we look at what happened in the 1970 eclipse on the East Coast, people who have been to eclipses or pay attention to what happens in eclipses knew that this was coming. And that was why we put together the task force, was to try and prepare. The problem is that you say, there's going to be this eclipse, and it's, this is the impact it's going to have. And people look at you like, really? Why? Why would it be like that? It's like, but seriously, it's like nothing you've ever seen, and people are going to want to come and see it. And really, there's a lot of places that have only caught on in the last, few months.
And exactly how rare is this thing?
So we get an eclipse somewhere on the planet about once a year. It's just less than once a year. So if you're willing to travel, you can see one almost every year. But most of the Earth is very inaccessible. So last year's was in Indonesia and over ocean. And most of the surface of the Earth is ocean. So most of the time, you're going to have to spend a lot of money to go on a cruise. So it's not that they're rare on a planetary scale, but they are rare on a local scale. So for the Kansas City area, the last time there was an eclipse over Kansas, that Kansas City area was 1806. So, you know, on average, it's actually 375 years between eclipses in a given place. But the range of, you know, gaps of between eclipses is huge. So we've got this one, you know, on Monday. And then in 7 years, there's another one that people on the east side of the state, so Cape Girardeau, St. Genevieve, that area, they're going to get to see a second one in only 7 years' time.
Huh. Angela Speck is my guest. She's co-chair of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force. You know, I'm hearing different things about the weather, Angela. It's going to be partly cloudy. It might be more sunny than that. 20% chance of rain Monday in the Kansas City area. To what extent could that put a damper on things?
So if it's really cloudy, there's a couple of different things that you can think about. If it's patchy cloud, then hopefully, you know, the patches don't get in the way. If it's, you know, a full, you know, the whole sky is cloudy, one of the things that happens during the total eclipse is that we get breezes, and those breezes can cause the clouds to be cleared out. So even if it's a little bit cloudy, it may get cleared out as we head into the eclipse. If it's really thick cloud and raining, it's probably not going to get fixed. However, it's still going to go dark for the time that it is totality. And for Kansas City, it's the northern half of the Kansas City area that's right. going to see that. But for if you're in the path of totality, it goes to full moon dark. So even if you cannot see the sky through the clouds, you're still going to experience darkness. And that's kind of cool.
Where are you going to be on Monday?
I will be at a rooftop bar on a hotel here in Columbia.
Pretty convenient, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hey, how do you think you're going to react to it?
Well, I'm actually going to be doing a live broadcast on one of the local TV stations, so I'm kind of hoping I don't lose it completely.
You think you might?
Yeah. So people say, you know, it's like, you know, falling in love, or people just burst into tears involuntarily, or, you know, it's like being introduced to your newborn child, that's the surge of emotion that you feel. And so I'm not really sure exactly how I'm going to react to it. I just have to keep it together enough and not curse, because that's the other thing that happens is that, you know, a lot of people, they curse when they're very emotional. And so you can imagine there's just this, you know, loud expletive coming out at the time. So, you know, being on TV is probably not my smartest move ever, but there you go.
Why the emotion attached to it? What's that about?
For people who've ever been to places where, you know, it's the first time they've seen something, it's like, wow. And it's not what even though you've seen pictures. So for people in Missouri, I can imagine that, you know, the first time you see the ocean, that it's like, wow, that's the ocean. And there's a level of, you know, this is amazing. Maybe not tear-jerking, but... Well, it's kind of the same sort of thing, but now this is something that you might not ever get to see again, and there's a lot going on. It goes dark in the middle of the day. It's completely different than anything you've ever experienced. So I think it's tapping into different senses as well. It's not just visual. It gets colder. Animals react. So there's a lot going on that all tap into how you're perceiving this event. And so, you know, the reaction is, oh, isn't that amazing? Look at that.
Huh. If you could pick any place in the country to be that day, where would it be?
So there are several different ways that I could answer that. Actually, if I didn't already live on the path of totality, I would probably go to near Alliance, Nebraska, because they have Carhenge.
And they have what?
Carhenge. It is Stonehenge built out of Cadillacs.
Oh, that's right. Sure. Right.
And I've been there, but, you know, this has been dubbed the Great American Eclipse. The U.S. is the only country that sees totality. Other countries see a partial eclipse, but only the U.S. gets to see the total eclipse. And there's something quintessentially American and astronomical about watching an eclipse over Stonehenge built out of Cadillacs. So I think that that's where I would go if I had any, you know, if I could go anywhere at all.
You know, we just did a show with David Barron in June, who has a book out, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. The book focuses on the eclipse of 1878, and there's a great scene in the book about people climbing Pikes Peak out in Colorado to watch the eclipse. And from there, they could see the moon's shadow racing across the land as it came toward Pikes Peak, you know, from that vantage point. What a great image that is in my head.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, depending on where people are in the U.S., they may be able to get that same sort of view. You don't need to be up a mountain. If you imagine you're in a place where you can actually see the shadows of clouds, so I'm thinking like big prairies or even just up a tall building where you can see out to the distance and it's flat land, you can see where, you know, the sun is blocked out by a cloud, right? And you can see it moving, but you're still in sunlight. Well, now imagine that that's what's happening, but now that shadow is much darker than the shadow of the cloud, and it's much bigger. It's 70 miles across, and it's moving towards you at 1,500 miles an hour. That is, you know, something that actually quite a few people on in the U.S. are going to get to see that. Even where we will be in Colombia, because we'll be on the roof of a building, hopefully we're going to get some of that view as it rolls into Colombia.
Or even from an airplane, you wonder what that would be like watching it from that vantage point.
So there's actually a really cool viral video that came out. So the last eclipse, the one that went over Indonesia, it actually went out of the Pacific, and Alaska Airlines changed the time of a flight by 25 minutes so they would intersect on a flight from Anchorage to Honolulu. And about half the flight ended up being eclipse chasers, people who want to see it. So there's this great viral video of a guy who used to work for CBS News and is part of our task force, just basically videoing it coming in. And you can see the shadow coming and him, you can hear him getting excited. And then it gets totality and you can just hear him going, "Oh my gosh, look at that, look at that. Oh my gosh," the entire way through for like 2 minutes.
Wow.
And this is a guy who's seen 10 of them before.
Wow.
You know, it, but that, you know, being up in a plane, and I know that there are some airlines that are offering that for this eclipse too.
I know you've been asked this a million times, Angela. Why are you so bullish on the idea of being in the zone of totality? And why isn't a 99.9% good enough in a situation like this?
So the way people need to think about it is that the sun is a million times brighter than the full moon. And what that means is that, you know, even when you've blocked out 99.9%, you've still got 0.1%. That's a thousandth of the sun showing. If you have a thousandth of the sun showing, it is still giving off more light than you get from the full moon. It's giving off a thousand times the light of the full moon. So it doesn't go dark. So if you are like in Kansas City, if you're at Union Station, you're not going to be in darkness. You want to go north from there, north of the convention center. And, you know, once you get into the path of totality, you will actually see a whole bunch of things that you cannot see unless you're actually in the path of totality. So,
is that why St. Joe, just north of here, will be one of the best places to view the eclipse?
So basically, being in the middle of the path gives you the longest time. You can imagine that there's this shadow that's rolling along, but it's not a square. It's kind of oval. And as it moves along, if you're on the edges, it only just touches the edges of the path. So you don't get very much time in darkness. And as you get up to the middle of the path, then you get a lot of time. St. Joe is great because it's really close to the center line of the path of totality, while still being a sizable city, so able to actually handle crowds. Because, you know, it also goes through Lathrop and Marshall and Lawson and Boonville and so on. But those are all much smaller towns. So, you know, St. Joe has this kind of sweet spot of being big enough to have infrastructure, you know, places to stay and eat and, you know, sanitation. And at the same time, being really close to the center line, so having a good long time in darkness.
Angela Speck is my guest. She's director of astronomy at the University of Missouri-Columbia. We're talking eclipse, which takes place Monday. Let's go to a phone call here. Florence from Kansas. Florence, good morning.
Good morning, host Steve and Jeff. I'm so excited about this event.
How can you not be, Florence? Yeah.
I'm pretty old. I was around for many years. However, I've often heard of that there are elements of danger watching an eclipse with the naked human eye. It can do damage to the eye. What causes that, the potential of danger? Could the guests explain the danger?
Right. How about the dangers of watching the eclipse, Angela?
Okay, so I want to start by saying that actually it's not more dangerous than any other day. It's not more dangerous to be outside. It's not more dangerous to look at the sun. It's dangerous every day. People don't stare at the sun, and most people know that they shouldn't stare at the sun. The problem is on eclipse day, you want to stare at the sun. So that's where the danger comes in. Now, during totality, when the sun is completely blocked out, it is completely safe to look at without anything. Naked eye, you've blocked out the sun. You're hiding the dangerous thing. And what you see is the atmosphere of the sun, but that's only as bright as the full moon. That's not going to hurt your eyes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay. You don't need any special protection during totality. But it takes about 90 minutes from the moon first starting to move in front of the sun to actually completely blocking it out. That's the partial eclipse phase. And if people want to watch that, they cannot look at it directly, just like they can't look at the sun any other day. And so you need to protect your eyes. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of different ways you can do that. There are eclipse glasses out there. At this point, they're getting pretty thin on the ground. People have been buying them up. But you can get them in, you know, big supermarkets and things, places like Walmart, Lowe's, you know, those sort of places mm-hmm. all have them. Some cities have got them for free. But and those block out most of the light. So they only let in a millionth of the light. So if you put them on even today and go out and look at the sun, it looks as bright as the full moon. And they're completely safe for looking at the sun. So you can use those in order to look at the partial eclipse phase. But if you can't get those, you can still do the pinhole camera, which I think a lot of people, you know, even my kids have built camera obscura type things in school where, you know, you have a box and you make a hole and it'll make an image at the other side of the box.
Right.
Well, you can do that. And it doesn't even have to be a box. You just need a hole to pass the light through. So a colander, you know, a pasta strainer, you've got lots and lots of holes. If you hold that up, you will sit and look at the ground underneath it. The shadow will no longer be lots and lots of circles on the ground. It will be a crescent as, you know, the moon is blocked out
right.
part of the sun. So there's lots of ways to view it safely. But basically, don't look directly at the sun naked eye ever. During the total eclipse, the sun is blocked out, so it's safe.
That's Angela Speck. She's co-chair of the National Total Solar Eclipse Task Force. She's one of the presenters at Friday's TEDxKC conference. For more information on how to view the event, go to TEDxKC.org. Angela, what a pleasure to have you. You just did a great job. And
thank you.
You made this all exciting, even more exciting for all of us, I think. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
I like this. Brian McTavish is in the house to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend, and that's Capital Cities.
Yeah, you like me too, though, right?
I like you too, and I like that song.
Yeah, yeah, because you like me because I bring you the stuff you like.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
And you like me for me a little.
Of course I do.
Okay.
After all these years together.
See, I need to clarify these things with you with other people listening, because
yes.
sometimes you're guarded. But here, everybody knows.
I'm German. That's what I am.
Oh, yeah. Hey, yeah. We'll get to Germany later.
Yeah.
I'm going to quiz you in just a bit about your favorite German fare, because, well, the Ethnic Enrichment Festival is coming. I don't want to spill the beans.
Is hamburger a German fare?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll go over it. Tell me about capital
German
cities.
German-American fair. Oh, I'm digressing beyond belief here. Okay, capital cities, pop anthem duo from L.A. You can catch them at 8 o'clock Friday night downtown at the KC Live Block Stage at the Kansas City Power and Light District. This music makes me happy.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I can tell it makes you happy.
Yeah.
And why is that? Because these guys know how to pump up not just the volume. Remember when you were a kid, turn that down.
Right.
No. These guys are going to be plenty loud, trust me. But they know how to make the notes sing.
Mm.
Sing. Okay, they broke out in 2011. That sounds good. They broke out in 2011 with the infectious top 10 hit we're listening to, Safe and Sound. Subsequent ditties included, I love this, I Sold My Bed, But Not My Stereo. Which, now that track did not do nearly as well for some reason on the charts, but it's darn good to know that at least these guys have their priorities straight. They have a new album, which is keeping up the personal anthems from these guys. And the album, it's an EP, an extended play project, and look for it. It's called Swimming Pool Summer. Have you hit the pool this summer?
No.
Neither have I.
As much as I'd like to see Capital Cities, I'm going to see the next group you're talking about here.
Oh, boy.
Which we're going to get to right now.
Excellent.
I hit the weekend just like a freak. I got there early. I couldn't wait. I made a friend or two. Along the way, you want the details, but what can I say? There's the ballerina, the foreign cartel.
Man, I like this group. That's the Dave Rawlings Machine.
Yeah.
Like them.
So, I knew you were with it, but you're actually hip, apparently.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
Whoa. Let's get this straight. You're going to go see the Dave Rawlings Machine.
Yes, I am.
Total Country Goodness, 8 o'clock Friday at the Folly Theater.
Yes.
But at the same time, you're telling me you're not hip.
Well, I must be kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And if you're looking to be kind of hip, follow Steve in to this show, Dave Rawlings Machine, Folly Theater, 8 o'clock. Boy, they can sing Oh, Whoa, Whoas, can't they?
Yes.
This is like, to me, Steve, I'd love to hear your thoughts since you're actually going to go out and do this. This strikes me as this sort of an old but new again sound, right?
Yeah, he's got a new album out. I like it a lot.
Oh, and, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like, you remember in the late 60s, early 70s when, you know, the Flying Burrito Brothers and the Byrds, these rock guys, they discovered twang.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered fiddles.
Yeah.
Well, this is, it kind of throws me back to that early 70s vibe.
What he's got.
Like
a
brand new fiddle encased in amber.
Who's
going to
be with them?
Who's
going to
be with them? You tell me.
His partner.
Oh.
I'm blanking on the
name. Yes, I have it here. Jillian Welch.
Jillian Welch is going to be with them. There
you go. They're longtime veteran singing, songwriting pals, cohorts, what have
you. She's terrific, too.
Dave and Jillian.
Right.
Yeah, they were even inducted into the American Music Association's Lifetime Achievement Award Hall of Fame.
Woo. Be sure to see Brian's 6 miscellaneous things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. And what do we have here?
Well, it's not German music, but
not quite.
Music from all around the world, dancing from all around the world, foods from all around the world, more than 60 countries.
It's a great event.
Yes, a great event. We'll be represented at the aforementioned Ethnic Enrichment Festival.
Yeah.
Friday night, all day Saturday, most of the day Sunday. Where else but the historic entrance to Swope Park? Now, what will you be looking for in the German food department if you should make it out there?
I may not go German. I think I might go Middle East.
Ooh.
Yes.
Do you have something you could, like, I have nothing in my head right now, which is obvious to all. But do you have something in your head that you might want to try?
Yeah.
How about something with noodles?
Yes.
Something with noodles.
Noodles.
Right.
Yes.
Now, I don't like things that I know what I'm eating. Like a noodle, what's a noodle, right?
Right.
But I mean, like, and I'm sure they'll have very, very nice things at the Ethnic Enrichment Festival to eat, and they'll all look wonderful. But I get nervous when I can tell that it used to be alive.
Yes.
Like a pig snout.
How about a falafel?
A falafel?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, no pig snout, but maybe a falafel. Check it out all weekend. Ethnic food and fun.
You need cooling, baby. I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you
I know the original. That's not the original, but it's still really good.
It's still really good. That's Les Zeppelin.
Wow.
Now, before anybody gets their dander up about the arguably provocative name of Les Zeppelin, look, if you want political correctness, then you're probably not into Led Zeppelin anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? Because weren't they the rock slash sex slash whatever you got gods from the 1970s? So this is all girls, all Zeppelin, and they're not just a novelty act, although I suppose one could argue they are at least that. They're great. They rock. Is that like to say they're going to show you a whole lot of love and as they climb that stairway to heaven? Where is this going to happen? 8 o'clock Saturday, under the sky at the Crossroads KC in downtown Kansas City, founded in 2004 by New York guitarist Steph Paines. So she's the brain trust. She's the female version of Jimmy Page. Spin Magazine called them the most powerful all-female band in rock history. I don't know. I'd probably go with Heart. Because those two gals, they were the whole band as far as I was concerned.
And I would also just recommend the annual Charlie Parker Festival is going on, beginning this weekend, going into next week.
Yes.
Go to the American Jazz Museum website for more information. And finally today.
I guess you say what can make me feel this way. It's my girl talking.
Wrap this up for us, buddy. Take us home.
Let's go all the way home on the grandeur of classic Motown. Motown, the musical, the story of what was once called, and accurately so, the sound of young America back in the 60s. It's on stage. It's ostensibly the story of Berry Gordy Jr., the founder of Motown Records, but you get it Thursday through Sunday night at Starlight Theater. You get 66 songs every night. Name one letter of the alphabet. Just one letter.
B.
Okay, B. How about Baby, I Need Your Loving?
We got to go. One? That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, Brian.
I got more letters for you. Okay.
On tomorrow's show, the revival of Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign, and we'll discuss race relations during the Trump administration. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.